Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hypergrowth Podcast. My name is Nikhil Bose.
And I'm Soham Moore. We've built this podcast with the goal of talking to a variety of individuals who have created unique mental models in which they make sense of the world. Our goal is to unpack and share some of these insights.
I believe the greatest ideas start as a blank sheet of paper.
In today's episode, we're incredibly excited to talk with Andy Chen, a partner at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield Byers, more colloquially known as KPCB. KPCB has backed over 800 entrepreneurs with investments in companies along the lines of Amazon, Google, Twitter, and Snap. Andy's the firm's first talent partner who started the well-known Fellows Program, which brings in top design and engineering students from universities across the United States into internship programs into the fund's portfolio companies. So without further ado, let's jump right into the episode. You've come quite far since you've graduated our university, UC San Diego. Do you mind giving us some context about your background and how you ended up at KPCB?
Sure. So, I went to UCSD to study engineering. And growing up, my parents were like, you're going to be an engineer, a doctor, or a lawyer. Fairly common in an Asian household. And I didn't want to be a doctor. I didn't think I had the right skill set. And I was really not interested in biology. I really did not want to be a lawyer. A lot of my friends ended up being in law, and a good number of them didn't like it. But I really found myself very curious about how things were built and spent a lot of time as a youngster building stuff like cabinets, houses. I was really excited when we go to IKEA. So I think engineering was a very natural fit for me. And so I went through college, getting an undergrad in mechanical engineering, and then stayed on another year for my master's to get a kind of degree in plasma physics and mechanical engineering. But the thing was, as I was graduating, I had worked throughout college to support myself. And so by the end of college, I had a pretty good understanding of what engineering was. And at the time, I was deciding between a few offers from really large, kind of, typical engineering firms. And as I was about to sign on the dotted line, I kind of asked myself, is this what I really want to be doing for at least the next 10 to 15 years, right? And is it going to take me closer to the goal of what I want to really do, which is to become an entrepreneur and to be close to that space itself? And it became very clear very quickly that that was not going to take me closer. Most of these engineering firms, you're working behind a desk and you're working on projects that can take 3, 4, 5 years, right? Especially in the area that I studied. And so luck may have it, a recruiting firm found my resume. They were focused on the Bay Area and they were focused on engineering recruiting for startup companies here in the Bay Area. What was interesting was I had the opportunity to work with really early stage companies. I had to work in the areas of tech, which I really liked a lot. And I would also learn how to build the firm itself. It was a really small company at the time and ended up being, today, it's actually one of the largest recruiting firms in the Bay Area. So to be part of that was really, really interesting. And I took a huge chance. I accepted the offer, graduated on Friday, drove up on Saturday to the Bay Area. Couldn't find a place to live, actually, because the job was full commission. I really didn't have any income and no one would give me a place to live because I had school debt. And I had just, I think, a few hundred dollars in my savings account at the time. And so I ended up living in the laundry room at a friend's place for a few weeks because that's the only place I could live. But on Monday, I started the job and it was an amazing work experience. By following my intuition, by following my gut and really seeking out the skills that were necessary for what I wanted to do in the beginning, I ended up managing a team, ended up learning sales, ended up learning recruiting. We ended up right across the street from Palantir's first office, actually. And so I recruited some of the first people to Palantir, recruited some of the first people to Zynga. We shared the same backyard as Facebook's first office on Hamilton Street. A lot of luck went into that. But I think the alternative would be to work at, like Northrop Grumman or Lockheed Martin and sit in a cubicle. So I think I got pretty lucky there.
Andy is clearly a very talented person who's done a lot of impactful things in different domains. A couple of things in particular really stick out to me in his story, and I'll go through them one by one. First and foremost, it's important to underline his desire for constant growth. Andy himself discusses how he met his experiences from different industries head-on and began to eventually learn all aspects of his trade, recruiting, sales, and just about everything. The sheer grit and determination he had to get where he is cannot be overlooked. He even slept in a laundry room to pursue a far more risky career as a technical recruiter in San Francisco. The second key point, as with many of today's successful leaders, is the importance of the role of luck in Andy's success story. The decision to join technical recruiting at a pivotal time in the industry along with the location of the recruiting firm itself, being in close proximity to the early HQs of Palantir and Facebook, was crucial to the success of both himself and the firm he represented. So if luck is needed to be successful, how can we maximize it? How can we engineer a formula so that we can guarantee success? Unfortunately, nothing yet exists, but we can try to define a rough equation over here. There's a quote from Oprah given at a Harvard Business School speech that I really, really like. She says, "My definition of luck is when preparation meets opportunity." By that statement, luck is proportional to preparation and effort. And thus, most of us aim to constantly increase our preparation by working hard and being better at our craft. But now, let's take your definition one step further by focusing on another variable, optionality, or the amount of opportunities available around you. And we'll argue that just like preparation, it's also a variable that you can control and likewise augment to increase your luck. The concept of optionality is introduced by Nassim Taleb, an extremely astute author whose work we will later reference in more detail. The simplified idea here is that in our complex world, we have a lot of inherent uncertainty. And the only way that we can combat that without Yoda-like insight or the ability to see in the future is with a wealth of optionality, as it creates a sort of wiggle room in which you can change the current course of your life. An equally important concept in optionality is a rational mindset that continuously considers the trade-offs of the different options and opportunities available and chooses accordingly. University is where many people can cultivate optionality, as university offers an unprecedented realm in which you can pursue a variety of career choices or internship opportunities, as well as a variety of networking opportunities to meet significant others, friends, and even possible business partners. Furthermore, for the students who have graduated, going to graduate school is another common way to increase optionality, as it allows for more time, more exposure, and more depth in a certain field. Working at a prestigious company or developing a large social network is similarly viewed to be enabling more choices and therefore more optionality. While luck by nature is random, here we make the argument that if you can simultaneously increase both the optionality around you and your preparation to meet these opportunities, you can truly maximize the amount of luck.
KPCB has been an institution in Silicon Valley since the days of the semiconductor revolution. How has the firm been able to stay competitive amid so many paradigm shifts and radical changes in technology and value?
KP, ever since its founding, we've been known to take really big bets. And, you know, we're not in the business of doing good at a lot of different things. We're in the business of doing great at a small number of things. And that inherently means that we're going to need to swing for the fences. Thankfully, that's allowed us to be investors in companies like Genentech, Amazon, Google, Twitter, Waze, Airbnb, and Spotify, especially relevant. But it also results in potentially some mistakes. So back in the early kind of 2000s, you know, fresh off of Amazon and Google, we pushed pretty hard into cleantech. And what we didn't realize was that cleantech was very capital intensive, and many of our companies couldn't raise enough money to get to the next major milestone. So before long, we were, I think, hundreds of million dollars committed with very few investments that we had hoped for that would succeed. But, you know, that's the nature of what we do, right? We're paid to take risks in hopes that we can change the world. And that's what, you know, I think is the thrill of being a venture. It's extremely hard. Very few people actually succeed at venture itself. But when done right, you can literally fundamentally change massive industries. And I think KP and you know, our cohorts itself, like Sequoia, our portfolio accounts for, I think, 15 to 20% of the Dow Jones.
Eugene Kleiner is aptly known as one of the godfathers of Silicon Valley. Following his departure from Fairchild Semiconductor, often noted as the first company from the Valley, he started the venture capital fund Kleiner Perkins. The premise of venture capital is fairly straightforward. Funds raise money from limited partners, or LPs, often wealthy individuals, with the expectation that these funds will invest in companies that yield orders of magnitude returns. 40 years ago, KPCB raised an $8 million fund to invest in primarily technology startups. Today, the fund has over $8 billion in returns. The most difficult part of venture capital is the art of selecting and investing in the right companies. If done right, venture capital not only provides a great method of investment, but also gives capital and mentorship to startups that desperately need it in the constant battle against the clock and the status quo. Venture capital funding has played a large role in building the cultures and tools we have today by pushing innovative ideas further and allowing them to progress and scale.
Working at KPCB, we're sure that you've met with some of the most talented entrepreneurs and thinkers of today. Have you recently encountered any beliefs or mental models commonly held by these people that you've encountered that have caused you to change the way you've approached everyday life?
You know, having been a Kleiner, my partner John, a lot of people can Google this talk itself, but it's the idea around missionaries versus mercenaries and, you know, what kind of entrepreneur someone is. At KP, we believe that missionary entrepreneurs are the ones that will build meaningful and significant companies. But it's a really good framework to look into. Randy Komisar also wrote, you know, part of his book, Monk and Real, talks about this as well too. But I think that mental model is really important, especially in this time where there's a lot of capital flowing into Silicon Valley. And as investors, you have a decision to make in the types of companies and types of entrepreneurs you want to invest in. And especially now, given the sheer amount of money coming into the system and available to entrepreneurs, I think you're seeing there's a lot of tourists, not literally people visiting the Golden Gate Bridge, but people who are here for the money and the fame, as opposed to the meaning and the value and, you know, substance of what they're doing. And so really honing in on who are the people that you want to invest in, spend time with, you know, both can make money, whether you're missionary or mercenary entrepreneur, but we believe that the missionary entrepreneurs are the ones that will change the world.
The idea of mercenaries versus missionaries that Andy referenced here is very important. So let's dive into a little bit deeper over here. The idea itself originated from John Doerr and Randy Komisar, both extremely influential venture partners at Kleiner Perkins and the original investors and board members at companies such as Google and Amazon. The argument made here is that the very mindset and attitude of a missionary entrepreneur is what KPCB is looking for in its company's founders, as it has shown time and time again to be a prerequisite in building and scaling the great companies of our time. Missionary entrepreneurs have the resilience, passion, and belief to build and scale for their cause despite any and all pushback. These specific breed of entrepreneurs are values-focused, and in John Doerr's terms, are fundamentally driven to make meaning. They're simply more than the allure of having the title of entrepreneur that motivates them. It's also important to point out that Doerr and Komisar are not promoting sheer altruism. Venture capital doesn't work like that. They are, however, simply stating that people that are driven by a mission are more likely to work through things when the going gets tough, especially over those who are simply driven by something more external, such as money or fame. But there's no need to confine this idea simply to the scope of entrepreneurship. I believe there should be missionary students, missionary software engineers, missionary bankers, etc. These people together can change the world because they're driven permanently by their mission. The first thing that would need to be changed for such a paradigm shift to occur would be a change in perspective from the current mercenary attitudes. Many people in our current society only look for what's in it for me, but very few start with what do I want to change in society and what is a problem that really drives me.
For our last question in this episode, what advice would you give to 20-year-olds that are still pathfinding and may not necessarily know what they want to do?
People that are young tend to think that life is a nice straight line. And so imagine for a second, you have a target and you got a bow and arrow. You load the arrow, you pull it back, and you line up your target and you release. And the arrow flies a straight path towards a target. But the reality is life is not like that. You know, life is, I don't know if anyone plays pinball anymore. It's like a game of pinball. The ball bounces around, you go in the gutter, you try again, and then you find a path to getting to where you want to be. However, you know, there really is no shortcut to being successful. It's a lot of hard work. And I always say, you know, if you want to have the best view, you got to live on top of a hill. But it's a lot of work to get there. So I think, you know, the reality is, try your best to plan as much as you can, but be open to change because opportunities can come out of left field and they can be very subtle. But when you see the opportunity, you have to take it. And I think people who think too linearly about their career, they miss opportunities where those opportunities can really transform kind of who they are. The second thing is, I think there's a tendency for people to follow other people's advice too much. But the problem is, like, that advice probably came from someone else. And so you're basically playing this long game of telephone. So kind of going back to my previous point about original thinking, you got to really dig deep and find out what's really important to you and have clarity around that. Because once you figure that out, you can chase that with all that you have. You know, oftentimes what you choose may not even map to what society tries to dictate as a priority. And so, you know, stick to that. Otherwise, you'll be in the middle of the bell curve.
Andy discusses how everyone's priorities and goals are unique. Therefore, you gain from thinking for yourself and not following everyone else's advice, because if you do, you may risk falling in the middle of the bell curve. What Andy talks about here is essential, and we're going to dive into it a bit more. To gain some clarity on this mental model, we once again look at the works of Nassim Taleb, a prominent modern-day philosopher and statistician. Taleb proposes an interesting thought experiment. Suppose you had 100 random people in a room and then proceed to measure their average height. You then add the tallest person in the world into that room and calculate the average height again. That one outlier wouldn't skew the average by too much. Obviously, it would get a bit larger, but surely not by much. Nassim calls this the land of Mediocristan, where outliers fail to make a big difference. On the other side, imagine if you still had that room full of 100 people, but now instead of calculating their average height, you look at their income levels, and then you introduce Bill Gates into that room. That would skew the average significantly higher. Nassim calls this the land of Extremistan, where outliers disproportionately affect the total. And both these lands, Mediocristan and Extremistan, apply all around us. Often, natural systems such as IQ, height, and weight follow the Mediocristan domain and can be mapped by a standard bell curve where outliers do not make a difference. On the other hand, modern-day systems such as wealth, investment prices, book sales, movie sales, music sales, all follow the Extremistan domain, where the majority of money lies at the top few percent of people, and an outlier can make a huge difference. The interesting thing to note here is that technology plays a large role in facilitating the shift from Mediocristan to Extremistan. To illustrate this, we're going to look at musicians. For the majority of history, as a musician, your reach was typically those around you, in your local village. Therefore, each village would have their good, their bad, and their average musicians. And if you happened to plot the income of all musicians, it would look something very similar to a bell curve. You got a couple really talented ones, a couple really bad ones, but for the most part, everyone's somewhat relative to one another. Soon enough, the record player was introduced, where music for the first time could be recorded and distributed around the world. And fast forward years later, the internet comes along, and music is more universal and free than ever, with the power of streaming. And if you look at all the profits of musicians now, it would look something very similar to a power law distribution, where we see the top 20% of musicians making 80% of the profits. Even when we think about venture capital, it fits into this model quite well. Tech startups, by nature, live in Extremistan. Therefore, the ones that succeed reap massive benefits for their investors. So if venture capital is done right and you invest in a good variety of startups, the money made off the winners, or the outliers, is enough to outweigh the majority of inevitable failures. It is commonly known in venture capital that 20% of a fund's investments are the ones that make the majority of the gains, making up for the remaining 80%. Now, as Andy mentions, by following the generic and commonplace advice of others, you risk falling in the average. While being in the average in Mediocristan is not that bad, the problem is our world is becoming increasingly Extremistan, and being average in Extremistan is not that good. Because of this, Nikhil and I firmly believe in tackling your future using a barbell strategy. Devote 80% of your time conquering Mediocristan domains. Go to college, get good grades, choose a secure career. Follow the status quo of what has led others to succeed. The other 20% of your time should be spent pursuing avenues that lie in Extremistan domains. Start a blog, grow a fitness Instagram, launch a podcast, work on a side project, create music, paint art, anything that remotely excites you, do it. While these things may be far more risky, along with it, as in Andy's case, comes the potential of massive, massive success. Think of this barbell strategy as an investment strategy in yourself, where you need to position yourself to be at least somewhat exposed to the unlikely, yet possible, returns of magnitudes that are only found in Extremistan domains.
Thank you so, so much for taking the time to listen to our episode with KBCB partner Andy Chen. Andy helped us dive deeper into thinking about luck, optionality, venture capital, and some of the recurring insights he has seen from leading the KBCB fellowship program. If you guys like what you're hearing, check us out and subscribe at hypergrowth.me. See you guys soon.